This is tape 3, the morning of January the 5th. The president now is Hillman present. Dave, you want to ask a question?
The question is that the seeds of the ultimate conflict resided in the North.
Ultimate conflict to what?
Between the North and the South.
Between the North and the South. War between states. Civil war.
On the one side, you had a highly industrialized North with the employer-employee conflicts going on within that situation, but the aided and abetted by and incited by the writers and the newspaper publishers, the pressure on the South was unremitting. There was the constant and unremitting cry for the abolition of slavery. No president up to that point had taken up the cry. No president of either party ran on any kind of a platform that approved of immediate abolition. In fact, they were more or less cleaning the implied constitutional provision, making slavery lawful. Wasn't that the thing?
That's true, and it was made lawful in the Constitution of the United States by referring to all other persons, as you find when the votes were to be decided on each section of the country. They said 3/5 of all other persons, which meant slaves. But the difficulty, real difficulty, was economic, because the South turned into a one-crop location, that is cotton, and used slave labor. The North had free labor, and of course, everybody, when he did any thinking on the subject, was against slavery. All the great leaders in the South, you will find, who, when they died, always freed their slaves. That is one of the things that they provided for when they passed away. But the operation of the government of the United States was on a compromised basis from the very beginning. The Congress was so set up that there was a balance of power in the Senate, a balance of power in the House. And when the Stephen A. Douglas in the 1850s caused the repeal of the Missouri Compromise under Franklin Pierce and the Compromise of 1850. Then the real trouble began, because that threw the whole western part of the country, west of the Missouri western boundary, open to settlement by those who believed in either slavery or in freedom. And that really brought about the principal cause of the war between the states, was the repeal of those two compromises. But it would eventually have had to come anyway, because slavery could not exist in a free country and have its continuation to proceed for the welfare and benefit of the world.
But the repeal of the compromise, in a sense, opened the doors to slavery in other states by permitting it, not necessarily legalizing it.
No, it didn't legalize it. It gave the people a chance to decide whether they wanted to be free or slave.
Well, didn't...
And that's what caused the trouble in Kansas and Nebraska and those other states. It's known as the Kansas-Nebraska Bill of Stephen A. Douglas.
I see. But didn't Douglas run, in a sense, on both sides of that argument? He said that any community that wanted it by a majority could have it.
That's right. And that was the Kansas-Nebraska Bill that Douglas introduced into the Senate of the United States.
But in the course of
he defeated Lincoln for the Senate in Illinois.
Well, but they say that he lost the election but won the argument, and that he, as a result of that, became a national figure, and that his arguments attracted all the states of the North to his point of view.
That's right. He ran for president, didn't get anywhere.
Well, now, Lincoln's own attitude was one of either avoidance or compromise on the issue of slavery.
That's right. That's that program that he pursued all the way through.
Excuse me, you say avoidance, Lincoln's avoidance. Didn't Lincoln say during the course of his debate with Douglas that the war, that the nation can't go on one half slave and one half free?
That's right, he did that, but when he became president, he made the statement that he would be perfectly willing to have half slave and half free to save the Union, have all slave where it was if it would save the Union, or have it all free if it would save the Union. And he finally freed the slaves on that basis.
In other words, Mr. President, here we are up against a classic example that government is really a matter of compromise and a balance of forces rather than any theoretical or very fine dream of anything.
That's correct. It's a decision between the people to provide a chance for peace and quiet in a community by compromise. That's all government is. The government, according to the preamble of the Constitution of the United States, is of and by and for the people. And that's all there is to it.
Well, but in terms of the uncompromising attitude that the South was taking, it had to take it defensively because it was outnumbered by 3-1 in population.
That's right.
Wasn't the South then seceding? Because South Carolina had already seceded at that time, had it not?
South Carolina seceded as soon as it was decided that Lincoln was elected. But South Carolina had been threatened to secede right along, just as Massachusetts had. Massachusetts threatened to secede too. South Carolina wasn't the first one in that line. And old Andrew Jackson happened to be president at that time. He told them if they didn't enforce the laws of the United States, he'd come to South Carolina and hang them all, and they knew he'd do it. So they didn't secede.
Yeah.
We'd had a strong president in James Buchanan's place. The Civil War probably would have been postponed for a generation, but I don't think it would ever have been stopped.
But didn't the South then set itself up so as to compromise it in another way by having two presidents? They wanted to have the president.
Well,
the South
they were trying to arrange the situation so they could have 11 states as the Confederate States of America under a constitution, which was adopted in Montgomery, Alabama. It's a good constitution, except for the secession part of it. And that was their program, that they were intended to have a free republic on the southwest section of the United States, which went as far west as Texas.
You think we ought to go back now, Mr. President, and talk about Pierce and Buchanan so that we can get up to the Lincoln period?
That's all right.
Just one more point here, Will. Now, the South was also being encouraged from the outside by Britain, was she not?
I don't think so. They always hoped that Britain would encourage them, but Britain never did. I don't think Britain was encouraging them. The South took the attitude that Britain had to have their cotton. And had they not taken that attitude, I think they'd have been better off.
Well, the South miscalculated, though. The South discovered too late that Britain had put in a tremendous inventory of cotton, and they could have withstood for some time. But in the meantime, the British reaction to Uncle Tom's Cabin and all the other agitation became pretty violent, too.
Another thing in connection with it was France was founding an empire in Mexico, and Britain was against it.
So these are all the wheels within the wheels that were working in the international constant turmoil of
that's correct.
Of everybody trying to expand at everybody's expense.
That's true.
Now, the point that you wanted to get back to, Bill, what was that?
To the presidency of Pierce, Mr. President. Can you sum up in general what you thought?
Franklin Pierce was from New Hampshire. He had been a brigadier general in the Mexican War, and he was a very popular man in the North and was a compromiser with the South. So when it came time to elect a president at that period, I think it was 1852, he was elected to succeed Millard Fillmore, who was filling out the term of Zachariah Taylor. He was overwhelmingly elected by both North and South. In fact, he was a compromise president, but he's the man who signed the bill that repeatedly compromises that brought on the Civil War. He was one of the best-looking men that ever was in the White House, but he didn't pay much attention to business as president of the United States any more than Buchanan did.
Well, he was one of the most vain of men that ever occupied the White House. And
well, that's on account of the fact that he was good-looking, I guess.
But he also had this terrible interest in being admired by everybody and pleasing everybody. He was kind of engaged in a constant popularity contest, wasn't he?
Well, he had one of the things that was troublesome to him. His wife was never interested in his political career and didn't want to go to Washington with him and I don't think she did. And that, of course, was a great handicap to him as President of the United States.
Jefferson Davis was involved with him, too. He was in his cabinet, wasn't he?
Jefferson Davis was the Secretary of War in his cabinet.
And had tremendous influence over Pierce, didn't he?
Well, yes. As far as the military program of the government was concerned, Jefferson Davis, I think, was the best informed man in the government at that time.
But didn't he exercise control pretty much over his other policies?
I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with that to say. I have here the rise and fall of the Confederate government, in which Jefferson Davis tells all about his career as Secretary of War in Franklin Pierce's cabinet. You have to look it up.
Pierce, in a sense, another one of the not only undistinguished, but the kind of compromise that took place in those days when, as you so well put it, they got tired of strife and they wanted to get on with the expansion business, so they wanted to put a figurehead in there rather than a leader?
I think that's correct. I think that's probably correct.
Now, isn't that a period also?
You never can tell, though, whether a man's going to be a figurehead or a leader when you nominate and elect him for president.
Well, accepting that there weren't too many surprises in the history of the United States presidency that way, were there, sir?
No, I don't suppose so, although we had some very, very poor sticks for president during that period, beginning with the man who succeeded Andrew Jackson. And then we had William Henry Harrison, who was elected on Tippecanoe and Tyler too, as we talked about a while ago. And then he was succeeded by John Tyler, and then along came Zachary Taylor, who was a military man. Didn't last very long, died in July, about a year and a half after he was elected, after he was installed. And then Millard Fillmore, who was a know-nothing and a natty Mason, would put on the ticket to get that part of the vote. And then along came Franklin Pierce, who was an easygoing, good-looking fellow, who liked to be considered a friendly man to everybody, and who had difficulty with his family when he was elected president. And then along came James Buchanan, who was an old bachelor from Pennsylvania, who believed that the principal role of the president was to enforce the laws and not to lead the country. And that's one of the reasons why South Carolina was allowed to secede without interference.
Now, are we all through on this one?
No, go ahead.
The question that sort of looms big in this whole period is whether our checks and balances got slightly out of balance with the Congress taking a great deal of the lead during that period.
Well, there were some very great men in the Congress during all that period, and the Congress always tries to hedge the president and keep him from doing his job if he let him. And the presidents that we've just named were perfectly willing that somebody else should do the work. They didn't like to work either. And Buchanan thought he was only the chief executive and that he had no power to lead the country, and that's what caused the trouble.
This is the end of tape number 3, the morning of January the 5th, 1961, I should add.
You're January the 5th.
correct. The president said I said December the 5th, January the 5th, 1961.
That's right. Well, I don't know where it's going there.
This is tape number 4, the morning of January the 5th, 1961.
That's right.
Now, you were expressing your opinion as to the constant interest of the Congress in encroaching upon the president or preventing a president from doing his power, and you've also referred to those presidents who have more or less limited their role in the presidency to being administrators of the laws without getting into leadership.
That's correct. We've had some very, very great leaders in the history of the country, beginning with Washington, who not only was the leader in the Revolution and the chairman, the president of the Constitutional Convention, he also set up the government, which was a difficult thing to do. Then the next great man of that period was Thomas Jefferson, who reestablished the government of and by and for the people. And then along came old Jackson, who took things over when he was elected in 1828, and became one of the great and strong presidents of the time. Now then, from Jackson on, we had a series of presidents who were chief executives and nothing else. And then along came Abraham Lincoln, who was elected on a minority vote, and who spent his whole period in the White House, which was 5 years, nearly 5 years, establishing the union and maintaining it. Of course, after he was assassinated, he was followed by the vice president, who was a man anxious to do the right thing, but was overwhelmed by a hostile Congress. And then he was followed by General Grant, who was just not even a chief executive. And General Grant was followed by Rutherford B. Hayes, who did his level best to do a good job, who was elected by a fluke, and he knew it. And then there along came the election of James A. Garfield, who was assassinated just about 3 or 4 months after he was inaugurated, and he was followed by
Chester Arthur,
who was the vice president when James A. Garfield was elected. And the thing that stands out, Chester Arthur, he took all the wonderful furniture that had been brought to this country by Jefferson and Monroe and several other of the great presidents of that period, and sold it at an auction for about $6,500, I think 9 van loads of furniture, any 3 pieces of which is worth more than he got for the whole business. I tried to get some of the pieces back when I was president of the United States, and they couldn't be obtained. People who had them wouldn't sell them at all. And then he was followed by Grover Cleveland, who reestablished the presidency, and not only as a chief executive, but as a leader. And Cleveland was followed by Benjamin Harrison, who was another man who didn't do much work. And then Cleveland himself went in on his second term. He was not the same Grover Cleveland he was to begin with. And he was followed by William McKinley, who was also assassinated in 1901. And he was followed by Theodore Roosevelt, who made a sincere effort to take the financial policy of the government away from Wall Street and put it back in Washington where it belongs, as Andrew Jackson had done in his period, and as Franklin Roosevelt did after that. That's the way these things run along. And Theodore was succeeded by William Howard Taft, who was a very, very pleasant, conscientious gentleman, but who was also of the opinion that all the president had to do was to be chief executive. And Taft was followed by one of the greatest of the great, that is Woodrow Wilson, who reestablished the financial policy of the United States as controlled in Washington, and also established a great many other reforms. And I think he would have had a great deal to do with the reestablishment of the presidency as the leadership of the country if this World War had not come along and we had become involved in it. And he was succeeded by Harding and Coolidge and Mr. Hoover. And then we had another very great president, Franklin Roosevelt. And I hope we can discuss all these things as they come along.
President, I'd like to get back to your theory that this document, the Constitution, is a great document. Nevertheless, from time to time, you spell out weak men who didn't seize the opportunities. So while the document is there, you do need men who know what they want, or who at least will seize the opportunities presented them to them by the document. Is that why you call the document a great document?
Yes. The Constitution is an outline of a government, and it's only an outline. It establishes a legislative branch, and an executive branch, and a judicial branch, and those branches of the government under the Constitution have certain powers and duties to perform. There are a great many powers and duties assigned to the Congress and to the President of the United States in the operation of the government, and any president who really wants to lead the country can do it under the Constitution of the United States. And he won't have to in any way infringe on the things that limit his power in the Constitution. He has plenty of power if he wants to use it. And there are very few of the great presidents who haven't understood that and who have followed through on what the Constitution provides. A great many of the other presidents just sat there and let the Congress do as it pleased, and they were the executive to enforce the laws. Well, the President has just as much right to decide what's constitutional as does the Congress or the Supreme Court when it comes to that, and that's what the great presidents have done.
Now, that, in a sense, you say that the Constitution is a roadmap which a president can either travel or leave alone, depending upon his disposition.
That's correct. It's a great doctrine, the government, Bill.
Oh, yes. It's just merely a roadmap which they can follow as well, because the president just cited that there were limitations
certain
on
limitations
the powers
on
each.
The powers of the president, but there are enough powers, not on which there is no limitation, that'll give him a chance to meet any emergency that comes up. And the only time that the Constitution has in any way been tangled up has been when foolish people want to legislate with the Constitution. That was the Prohibition Amendment and its repeal, and the 22nd Amendment, which is another very bad amendment. And there have been amendments offered which would really put the government of the United States out of business, the states out of business. The so-called Bricker Amendment, some of the worst things that ever been presented to the Congress of the United States, which have been crippling amendments to the Constitution, have been offered by the Republican Party.
In other words, some of these amendments don't amend the Constitution, they actually curb it, don't they?
They're legislative documents attached to the Constitution, and that's the trouble with most state constitutions. They legislate the Constitution, which shouldn't be done.
That's interesting. You use the term that they're legislative constitutions or they're legislative
documents instead of constitution. Constitution is an outline of government which protects the people, and it sets up a legislative branch to legislate. It sets up an executive branch to enforce the laws and to lead the people, and it sets up a judicial branch to decide on the difficulties that arise between the citizens of that part of the world which they work in. And when they make a legislative document out of a constitution, it no longer will work. That's the reason the states have to write new constitutions every once in a while.
In other words, you describe the Constitution as a sort of a conception of government rather than a spelling out of the detail of how the government is to be conducted.
That's correct. It sets up a government that will work for the welfare and benefit of the people, and then the legislative branch of the government is supposed to legislate to enforce the provisions which set up that part of the government. And then the executive is a man who is supposed to be a leader who will enforce the laws as they're passed by the legislative branch, and the judicial branch are the ones that settle the troubles between the various citizens in the
And so far as the president is concerned, it's as much an enabling document as it is a limiting document.
That's right. That's exactly what it is, an enabling document all the way through.
And what you're saying, Mr. President, that a legislative constitution isn't, in fact, not only an enabling constitution, but tries, in effect, to lay down the condition for every little incident which will arise. And you can't do that, can
That's
you?
The truth. And if they do that, the little incidents which they want to lay down are things that are locally taking place at the time the Constitution is written, and it's not written for the future. Whenever they legislate in the Constitution, these legislative acts of theirs in the Constitution become obsolete. That's the reason they have to write a new one.
Now, as far as you're concerned, with the exception of the slavery issue, the Constitution pretty well anticipated the future in many of its ramifications without any of those being even immediately effective or important to the United States.
I think it did. I think those men who made up the Constitutional Convention in 1787 were men who were familiar with the history of government from the beginning. They were young men, and they wanted to set up a document that would be a continuing document, and that's just exactly what they did.
And in other words, their conception was such that they didn't want to tamper with local or temporary problems, but to set up a government which would have scope.
That's right, in which the legislative and the executive branches of that government would have the power to deal with local questions as they came along.
Now, the problem of leadership, then, is vested in the president with practically no limit as to the range of leadership that he is to exercise in the presidency, providing he didn't failed to coordinate with the Congress on certain things that the
That's
Constitution
true.
Made it necessary for him to do.
That's true. He has six jobs, every one of which is a full-time job. And when he carries out those six jobs, he becomes a leader. He doesn't.
Now, the thing you said a while ago about the president being able to interpret the Constitution, or being entitled to interpret the Constitution for himself, as well as the Congress or the Supreme Court would. Did you mean that only in times of emergency or all the time?
I meant that whenever the president has to make a decision, he has to decide whether it's in conformity with the Constitution. And his judgment is just as good as the judgment of either one of the other branches of the government. And you find that Jackson told John Marshall exactly where to get off when he told Jackson he couldn't do something. Jackson said, all right, he's made his decision, I'll let him enforce it. I can enforce my decisions.
Well, except that's the point, that where a president does interpret the Constitution in a way that he thinks is correct, he may run into difficulties either with Congress or with the courts.
That's natural. He will.
We'd like
and if
to
he's not in a fight with the Congress and the courts, he's not doing a good job.
Because we want to get to the courts and the Dred Scott decision and what it had to do with the problems that had developed in the Civil War.
But bad situation. They had an old man as Chief Justice when that Dred Scott decision was made. It's too bad.
He got into the cabinet later, didn't he, or something?
He was there first.
Yeah,
he was Secretary of the Treasury.
Oh, Samuel Chase?
Well,
No. This is
Tony.
Can we get back to that, Mr. President, in the next tape if we have time?
All right.
Is tape number 4, the morning of January the 5th, 1961.